Hello, everyone, and welcome to our one-night show. Just take a seat. They're always free. This is Every Pod You Cast, a podcast dedicated to the rock band The Police. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here. You may know me from the Cinema Joes podcast, as well as Pod on the Rooftops, a podcast dedicated to the rock band Genesis, as well as Podbrook Angels The Rush Hour, a podcast dedicated to the rock band Rush. And joining me is one of my co-hosts from Podbrook Angels, Chris Mancini. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Justin. I woke up in my clothes again this morning, but I don't know exactly where I am.
Do any of us, Chris, really, in the grand scheme of things? But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. And we'll see if maybe he knows what we're talking about. He is the host of the newly minted podcast, I believe, Media Lit. It's Randy Elaine. Hello, Randy.
Hey, how's it going, Justin? I put my headphones on, and it's great to have your voices inside my head right now. Before you know it, we'll be nothing but shadows in the rain.
Wow, man. I was wondering how long that train was going to go. That's
not nearly as long as the title of one song on this album.
Yes, which I'm sure we'll mention many times on this particular episode. Well, to all our listeners, this is a podcast where we discuss each of The Police's 5 studio albums, discussing our general thoughts, songs we like, songs we don't, favorite lyrics, and favorite musical moments. And this episode, we are tackling Zenyatta Mandata from 1980. This is, as I said, this is the 3rd studio album from the band and the 3rd consecutive album of theirs. Having put out albums in 78 and 79 previous to this. So I'm going to start before we get into all of our fun little categories. I'm going to offer a little bit of history around this album. Last that we left the band, they had just put out Regatta de Blanc. And it takes some time, but this album really starts to catapult them into fame. And it helps that there's a lot of hits on the album. But they also not only are touring in the places they've been touring, Europe and America, but they start touring internationally. And this is a huge endeavor on Miles Copeland, the band's manager's part. He gets them to other countries. India is a big highlight. And Miles actually talks in the book that I've been reading. He's on record as saying that, you know, this was a time where magazines were putting out all these pictures of bands and they all kind of look the same. But what happened if you got a band and just dressed them up as Maharajas? That would really stand out. And so this was all part of the calculation on Miles' part to make The Police the biggest band in the world, something that he, I would say, was successful at for even if it was for a short period of time. But in this span of time, The Police do have a little bit of off time, and this is where Copeland starts recording more Clark Kent material, which I know Randy has brought up before. they start getting some pressure from the record label, A&M, which has been in a bit of a funk lately in terms of its financials, and they really need a hit album. And at this point, The Police are looking pretty good. So they start saying, hey, you guys are going to put out another album? And The Police are like, I guess so. And unfortunately, this sort of pressure doesn't necessarily lead to the best atmosphere for writing and recording an album. They end up recording this at Visselord, a studio in Hilversum, Netherlands. They wanted actually originally to record at Surrey Sound, where they recorded the previous 2 albums, but they do not for tax reasons. And this time, as I've mentioned before, there were fewer songs to start, even fewer than they had for Regatta de Blanc, and not a lot of time to record them. So because of this, you have a lot of songs on here that feel like they were kind of made up on the fly, that maybe came from some jam sessions. And the title of the album is kind of another bit of nonsense from the band, but is taken, the etymology, I guess you'd say, is from some existing words, Zen being one of them, Monde, the French word for world, the Kenyan president, Jomo Kenyatta, as well as riff on Regatta. Why not? Let's do that one again. So it's kind of the thing where, yeah, they're kind of bringing together all these influences and a bit of a hodgepodge, which I think describes the album to a certain extent. But yeah, this is a real interesting one. And I'm really curious to hear what my co-hosts have to say about Zenyatta Mandata. And I'm going to throw it to Chris first. How do you feel about the third Police album?
Yeah, I still think it is a very good album. It's probably my least favorite of the three we've heard so far, but it's close. So it's not like the other two are blowing them out. I think composition-wise, like, similar to the first two, like, it's stronger in the first half than the second half. Not to say that there aren't still some gems on the back half, as there are with the first two. But I think perhaps the thing is, like, there aren't as many... There's still, like, great songs, but maybe not as hard hitters as Roxanne, Message in the Bottle, and some of the stuff that came before it. I mean, maybe Don't Stand So Close to Me is pretty high up there too, but I think there's still some, you know, great songs on the album, and I think there are a couple songs where I think aren't as strong, and I would say there was like two where I was like debating which one I wanted to talk about for King of Pain, but whereas maybe the other ones were a little bit harder to pinpoint. And then I think the other thing is I do feel like it kind of bounces around between stuff, and it can be kind of interesting to like go back and forth on some stuff, but maybe in terms of cohesiveness, maybe it feels a little less so in the last album for sure. So all that to say, I think it has a lot of great moments, and maybe there are parts that are a little low, but maybe that also allows for some of the instrumentation to stand out. But I can't say I'm surprised that this kind of was pulled together quickly, because it kind of feels that way.
Yeah, it's you know, it definitely has its it has its charms, it has its blessings, I would say. And this is an album that's kind of won me over the more I've listened to it. I remember when I was kind of getting, you know, sort of listening to it afresh, you know, before this episode, I was kind of like, all right, you know, it's definitely not standing out to me as much as the first two. But the more listens that I did, I think the more grooves I noticed, the more grooves that I was really getting into. I do feel like there are some definite classics on this album, but I will say, I feel like to me, there's not a lot of bad here, but there's maybe not as much great as there has been on the last two. And I would agree with you, Chris. So far, this is my least favorite of the three, but I'm still overall positive on it. I still think there's a lot. I like that this is a kind of bouncy album. It feels a lot more pop than the last two albums. I can feel the strain of a lack of material. That definitely comes through. And yeah, it's a fun album. I do feel like it's maybe missing a bit of vitality that was maybe in the last two albums. So I guess that's where I'm at with it. But Randy, how do you feel about this album?
Well, we'll see if we'll see if we end up disagreeing on any tracks. But I think as far as the overall album goes, I'm 100% with you guys. Yeah, there's nothing bad here. This is very much a vibe of an album. I think you could put this on, you could let it play. You wouldn't even always necessarily consciously realize that you are switching tracks, but there's an energy that's positive. It's fun and enjoyable. We certainly have some outliers here. As you know, I really loved watching the Andy Summers documentary, Can't Stand Losing You, Surviving the Police. And it was really interesting hearing his take on this period. The way he describes the album coming together, first and foremost, this is where he talks about like really starting to feel the tension with Sting, like within the band, starting to wonder when the other shoe is going to drop. You know, he says, you know, I've wondered ever since we completed Regatta de Blanc how long Sting would play this game. He's not a team player. He doesn't want to share credit. And he makes comments in the press to that effect. He's starting to feel some tension here. But in terms of this album, he says gradually something like an album emerges, but we're short of material. And then maybe the wildest thing is he says on the last day before we leave on this world tour, we come to the conclusion that the mixes aren't right. And on a kamikaze mission, remix the entire album in one night. We wind it up at 6 a.m. and Zenyatta Mandata is ready to go out into the world. So if that doesn't support wow. that sort of slipshod coming together that we felt, you know, I don't know what is. But yeah, the tension here is really palpable. Another highlight from that documentary is following that world tour and the release of this album. You know, this is where Andy's wife asks for a divorce shortly after that world tour. Things are really falling apart. At the end of that tour, after all this time away from his family, Andy just decides to hang out in Bali for 3 more weeks with Stuart Copeland. And he tells a wild story about they hung out for a few days with John Belushi doing magic mushrooms. They ran into John Belushi in Bali. Yeah. He says there was a restaurant serving magic mushroom omelets. And they are just hanging around with John Belushi. He's got all these photographs. And so it's not so surprising that home life is not looking great for Andy when he finally makes it back home. But yeah, it's so interesting to see where we are at this point in the history of the band, but also so much cool musical stuff happening. I think one of the most fascinating things about this album to me is there are at least two different songs that I think you have to call ska songs. We've seen a lot of reggae influence, but you know, we see some more of this world music coming to the forefront. So I think this is going to be an interesting conversation. I have no idea where people are going to go with their favorite tracks and Kings of Pain. So I'm really excited. I hope we get some fun surprises.
Oh, I'm sure we will. That's for sure.
Hello, I'm Daniel Cohen, former film editor of thepopbreak.com, and I've got a Batman podcast for you. We discuss Batman's past, present, and future, and do a lot of rankings episodes. Yes, we rank the movies, villains, but that's not all. We even rank all the Batman movie trailers throughout history. Yes, we rank Batman trailers. I dare you to find another Batman podcast that did that. So join me and frequent hosts Alex Marcus and Bill Bakken, as well as a plethora of Bat guests, as we discuss Batman and plenty of DC on film as well. Also, fair warning, I'm a BVS fan, but don't let that scare you away. Trust me, I get mocked and ridiculed more than the Martha line for taking that stance. So relax and tune in on the last Tuesday of every month on the Pop Break Today feed.
Hey there, this is Josh.
And this is Aaron.
And we're the hosts of the Anniversary Brothers podcast.
The podcast where we talk about the anniversaries of your favorite TV shows and movies.
Hey, Aaron, what do Muppet Treasure Island, Arrow, and The Birds have in common?
They all feature bird puppets.
Close. They're all movies and shows we've covered on the pod.
Find our film podcast on the Pop Break Today feed.
And find our TV podcast on the Pop Break TV feed. Thanks. Bye.
So we're going to start with our Love You Since I Knew You. This is a song that we want to spotlight, we maybe think is underrated, or just a song that we really like and want to talk about. So I'm going to actually go back to you, Randy, for this one. What's your Loved You Since I Knew You?
All right. So as we were all saying, it was hard for a top track to emerge for me. I had a lot of songs in contention. And at the end of the day, I think I had to lean into just liking that sort of silly new wavy Stuart Copeland vibe. We know that that's how I feel. So I landed after much deliberation on Bombs Away as oh, my nice. Favorite track. So here are some of the reasons I landed on Bombs Away. First and foremost, thematically, it really appeals to me. You've got this vaguely, loosely political song. It's sort of condemning these non-specific military leaders who come across as corrupt in the context of the song. You know, one of the first times I chatted with the two of you, we were talking about Black Sabbath, and I talked about the song War Pigs, which I really love, that digs into that. And then something with a tone. It's not a top tier David Bowie So he has a really great song from Hunky Dory called Bombers that's just like vaguely tying into this Cold War sort of fear. And in the song, you've got this general who's running this war and yet is also having these romantic daydreams about, you know, some guerrilla warrior girl that, you know, seems to really get him going and excite him. So for him to have this enemy that he sees as exotic and alluring, but doesn't really want to understand on a real way, just kind of builds that picture for me. You know, I think it might be getting a bit carried away to give the band too much credit for this being like their top political track. I think we're going to have a lot more fun stuff to say about that when we get to the next Police album. But I think it's a little bit of a precursor to that vibe. But yeah, I really love the sort of like bravado, the machismo that this song is challenging and taking on. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's got some really fun guitar from Andy in there, you know, for me, almost simulating this bomb drop and, you know, that just dropping these bombs, that's going to solve our problems. So that's fun for me. It's got some silliness. It's got a little bit of that jokey, sarcastic-y sort of delivery in the singing. But yeah, the vibe works for me, and I'm going to land on that as my loved you since I knew you.
Very nice. I'm very happy to hear that, because that's one I was kind of debating. And yeah, it's a really fun song. It's one of the songs that I feel like going into this, I wouldn't have said I was a big fan of it. And then just listening to the album over and over again, I'm like, man, I'm really digging this one every time. It is political, but it's also like, it doesn't feel like it's trying to do too much. Like, it doesn't feel pretentious at all. It feels like it's more just kind of like, I mean, I love that the opening line is the general scratches his belly and thinks, which, you know, that just, if that doesn't give you an image of someone who's fully removed from any immediacy of battle, I mean, I don't know what will, you know, and the bomb's away, but we're okay. That's, I mean, it's a very funny song. You know, in a sort of in a light way, but also in a kind of dark way. You know, you just really get the sense that whoever's making the decision, whether it's the generals, whether it's the president, where his country reeks, like these people just have no idea about like boots on the ground or anything that's actually happening. They're too far removed from it. And I think the song, like the song and its and the fun in it, I think kind of reflects that and belies, you know, maybe some of that darkness and that remove and the consequences of that for the people who are actually fighting the war, who are not characters in the song, but I feel like their presence is sort of under a lot of this. And, you know, to be honest, I think it's emblematic of some of the other songs on the album where it's kind of light and fun and bouncy. And then you get into the subject matter and it's actually kind of dark if you start to think about it. So, yeah, really, really nice choice.
Oh, yeah. This was definitely a song that was in contention for me for this like for Love Since I Knew You. Ended up wanting to highlight a different one, but this was definitely up there, and actually I put it in a different category, so I will come back to the song later. Definitely agree, like not something I thought coming into it that I would like as much as I did. And I, you know, heard the album a few times beforehand, but yeah, this definitely stood out more to me on further listens. And I also heard it was written on like a backing track of Susie and the Banshees. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know like to what extent that like influenced the song, but it was under the same like record label. So
wasn't he using the record itself?
Isn't yeah, he? I think so. Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see like what track like they like wrote over.
Actually, the only other thing I was going to say, this might be the best moment for me to bring up this quote I've been dying to find an excuse to bring into our Police conversation. You know, I think I might have mentioned this in passing, but, you know, Stuart Copeland's dad was one of the like original operatives in the CIA. And, you know, that is why Stuart Copeland, you know, spent his life overseas despite being born in Virginia. And, you know, he didn't even find out until he was in college when his dad published a book that he was actually this like destabilizing agent working in places like Iran. And then, his dad retired from the CIA and he went on to have this like sort of like punditry career where, you know, he loved to go in and, you know, be kind of charming and smart, but also very like tough talking and irreverent and whatnot. But it's been on my mind this week for all reasons, because of Taylor Swift. There have been these kind of silly like right wing conspiracies about Taylor Swift being accused of being a government psyop, trying to like influence the upcoming election and things like that. The reason that made me think of the Police is because in 1986, Stuart Copeland's dad, in a Rolling Stone interview, jokingly implied that the Police were a psyop. He was saying it jokingly, but apparently, you know, he concluded the interview by implying that the Police were a psyops outfit who played shows to 70,000 young minds open to whatever the Police decide to put into them. And this created some tension with Sting. He was really pissed off about this. So anytime I see, you know, the band playing around with political subject matter, I do think a little bit about Stuart. I mean, he's credited for this song Bombs Away. And I'm curious if there's any rebellious side to this or if it's merely him having fun reflecting a theme that was popular in music. But intriguing stuff, and the aura and mystery of the band only gets bigger.
Yeah, it's wacky, but it's amazing how that stuff picks up traction. And I did just want to mention two other quick things about the song that really jumped out to me this time. The way that Sting sings Hard and Sweet, I just every time love it. Also, like the outro guitar solo from Andy is really awesome. I just love the sound, the feel of it. He's really having fun, you can tell. So they're adding a lot to this Copeland composition, for sure.
I know, I was a little bit worried about coming in, and it's like, oh, Randy's just having fun watching Stuart Copeland be weird again. But yeah, that solo really does genuinely rock. It's one of my favorites on the album.
So, Chris, it sounds like you didn't go with Bombs Away for your Love You Since I Knew You. So what song did you go with?
I went to the track before it. Voices Inside My Head. Also not a song I thought I would highlight, but it really grew on me. Just love the funky bass that Sting lays down. And I love how the guitar and bass kind of play off of each other, where it's like the guitar plays and then like the bass answers. So I thought that was really cool. And then like the vocals sound like multiple voices, so it kind of has like the echo quality of it to lend itself to the content of Voices Inside My Head. And then Stuart does a great job of playing around the groove. And I think it's an interesting structure to the song too, where it kind of starts off with that. And then in the middle, you have the repeating like cha sound. Like, cause like the first part kind of becomes hypnotic cause it's kind of like repeating itself. And then, like, the cha kind of breaks it up. And then, like, you get to this weird, freaky part at the end where you have, like, the guitar becomes a lot more scratchy. You have a lot more echoing vocals or vocals on top of vocals. And then even, like, the drumming starts to get a little more erratic where you hear, like, the double drum roll. So I feel like it's something, like, echoing inside your head that eventually drives you crazy is the journey that it takes me on. While I can't really equate to that, or maybe not to that degree, I can equate with it, but I appreciate what it, the evocative things it makes me think about when hearing it. So something again that maybe not a highlight for most people on the album, but something that really stood out to me as I was re-listening to the album.
Yeah, that's I gotta admit, that was not where I thought you were gonna go for this category, but I have to be honest, this is a song that at first I was like, okay, maybe this is gonna be my King of Pain when I first started, and then just like the more I listened, I was like, no, I really like it. Like, it does, like, you start noticing more of the subtleties and the intricacies, I think, as you were alluding to, in the structure. I just was surprised how much like, oh no, I'm actually like, even like the way it begins is really interesting and very unlike some of the other songs. I almost think of this song as a bit of a sequel to the title track from Regatta de Blanc, where it's like you can tell it's like kind of minimalist, but like they're really like you could tell like this kind of came from a jam and they're kind of seeing where they can take it with like, you know, minimal but still intricate instrumentation. So yeah, that's a really, really cool choice. I really like that one.
Yeah, I like that choice as well. I think that was on the list of three or four songs that like internally I was having a hard time fully distinguishing from each other. But I don't mean that necessarily as a negative, because I think those are also the tracks that define maybe what the best thing about this album really is. That sort of jam session feeling where the pieces come together and the moments where they grab your attention with something little, right? Like every time I listen through this, a different song is grabbing me. You know, most recently I was at my son's basketball game last night and I was just listening to this album in my earbuds while the game was happening. And yeah, like it, every listen, a new song grabs me. And there were times that it was Voices in My Head. So great pick. I love that it's on here.
I feel like I need to know now, like, what songs were playing. Like if your son, like, managed to score a basket, like, what song happened to be playing when you're, you know, that's, now I want to know that, but that's another podcast, I guess.
You know, we didn't get any, like, super clear sync-ups. However, during Bombs Away at one point, we did get a little flurry of scoring, or whatever a flurry of scoring looks like in a middle school basketball game of you know, fourth and fifth graders, but
right.
It was a tight
three
game.
And three, it was got one. It.
Yeah, from Steph Curry range. Well, I'm gonna go somewhere else, and actually it's the song right before Chris's pick. It's Canary in a Coal Mine. This is one that I just always remember being like insanely catchy, like maybe one of the catchiest songs that they've ever written. So it just, the riff is so good. I love the tone of the guitar. I don't know exactly like what they're doing, but it's almost like I'm listening to it and it's like, it's almost like the strings are made of rubber bands or something. It just has a very interesting like resonance to it. And I really love the way Sting sings on this. He is really enunciating the end of each line and rhyme in particular, which does make some of the slant rhymes really stand out. But yeah, it's just, I do feel like this song is very indicative of this album, that sort of bouncy sort of pop tone I mentioned before. It's very comedic. It seems to be about someone who is, let's say, easily rattled by life. This is the title, for those who don't know, is taken from an old mining practice where canaries would be taken into the mine by the miners. And this was a way to show whether there was toxic gas in the mines, because the canaries would become sick before the miners would. So it was kind of like an indicator of like, oh, shoot, like we need to put on our mask, or we need to make sure that we're out of this particular part of the mine. But yeah, it's and that's really interesting to use that, talking about this person who, you know, seems like they're like a hypochondriac. Seems like, you know, everything bothers them that possibly could. I just think using that sort of image of a canary in the coal mine is like someone who's like, oh, there's a problem here. Like it's a really kind of funny image. And also the song is very short. It's about 2.5 minutes long, if that. But you have like a really nice like mini piano solo in the middle of it. And it's just really unexpected, but it just really fits in with the comic tone of the whole thing. I just think it's a really successful, you know, sort of like pop rock song. And one that I find very infectious.
Yeah, this was a song I thought I would pick going into it. And I ended up changing it at the last minute. I think part of it was like I had a hard time like explaining why I liked it so much. But I think you succinctly, you know, covered what makes it so compelling, even though it is short. A bit repetitive, but it's just really fun, fast paced reggae. I believe there's some guitar overlay happening as well.
Yeah, I think so.
And I find it funny that like that piano solo, like I think the guitar like that's the only part that the guitar stops at, is to have that piano solo, and again it gets right back into it. But and yeah, and agree, like the idea behind, I like the metaphor of the canary in the coal mine too.
Yeah, this one's got such a fun upbeat energy to it, and it's almost It almost feels so saccharine. I think it's one of those songs when I first heard it, I was like, oh, this song's kind of dumb. But then before long, I realized, no, I truly love it. I'm truly enjoying it. Reggae and ska are so intimately connected. I think you could argue that this one dips into ska territory with just like the pacing of it, which is a lot of fun for me. The metaphor is fun. And it also got me thinking pop culturally of Sting on The Simpsons. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this episode. They need to dig Bart out of a well and they get like a celebrity sort of fundraising, attention getting campaign. And, you know, Sting is down with his shirt off, like helping to dig Bart out of the well or whatever. But there's a reference to this song because at one point they're underground, all the townspeople working, and the canary dies. So they all leave, they go to the surface, and the doctor determines, no, it's okay, it died of natural causes. So they go back down
that's funny.
into the mine, and they're able to do it again. So that was a fun little pop culture memory that it evoked as well. It's so nice to see us on the same track again for our favorite songs.
yeah. Well, you know, there's still two albums to go, so there's still time to revert. Well, let's see where we go here, because now it's time to talk about our King of Pain. These are the songs that maybe we don't like as much. And I didn't tell you guys which songs, but I have a guess for each of you where you went. So we'll see if I'm right. I'm going to go to Chris to start us off this time. So, Chris, what is your King of Pain?
Well, I believe it was between two, and I listened to both of them quite a few times, and it was between Behind My Camel and The Other Way of Stopping, and Shadows in the Rain. As I listened to both, I think ultimately the thing that sealed the deal for me was Behind My Camel won Best Instrumental Rock Song of the Year when YYZ came out the same year. And that was enough for me to be a little bit mad that this song won over YYZ. So my pick is Behind My Camel as okay. My King of Pain.
I thought you were going to go Shadows in the Rain. So I was at least close.
I was thinking about that one. I think there are a couple of things that save Shadows in the Rain for me in learning a bit more about it. And I can appreciate them like experimenting, and not to say that like Summers didn't experiment with Behind My Camel. I just feel like he had a good idea and then didn't know what to do with it. When I first heard this song, I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, it's got this really like ominous tone to it, really atmospheric keyboards, and I like the tone of the guitar, but I felt like it didn't go anywhere, and it just felt very repetitive. And so, you know, part of the time I was listening to it, I was like, okay, like, where's it gonna go next? Just felt like the whole time I was stuck behind my camel. Also, I find it funny that Sting hated this song so much that he buried the recording in like the garden or something, or like in the backyard or something. And then my understanding was Copeland, I don't think it was his favorite either, but he tolerated it, and he's like, I guess someone's gotta provide drums on it, because these two bozos certainly aren't going to do it. So so I feel like I'm a little bit justified, because at least 2/3 of the bands weren't particularly thrilled about having the song on here.
Yeah, I love what you had to say, Chris. And this song makes me appreciate Stuart Copeland even more for being so willing to do the work of collaboration here. There's something interesting about this song that I really do appreciate. Perhaps you'll hear more from me on that later. But the way that Sting just kind of pieced out on this, Andy's laying down the bass tracks on his own for this song. It's a bummer, because if the collaboration had been fully alive and healthy, I feel like there could have been something really special here.
I have kind of mixed feelings about this song. Like, it was sort of in contention, but ultimately, like, like, I don't disagree with you, Chris, that I don't feel like it goes anywhere, and that's like what maybe holds it back. But I think what's there is like still kind of fascinating and dark and threatening in a way that I really enjoy. So I'm just like, I don't know. There's pros and cons. Like I don't mind hearing it, and it's not long enough where it feels like it drags out for too long. But yeah, is it as good as YYZ, my number three Rush song? No. It's not quite in that league, and it's not quite up to the standards of the better Police songs, for sure. But I think there's something there. So yeah, I'm of two minds about it. I did also just want to say really quick that I was reading an interview about the song, and actually it was a band interview. They were talking about it. They mentioned some of the things that you guys have brought up about how much Sting hated it. And at one point, the interviewer brings up the fact that this is the one Police song that the band Primus covered on their Rhinoplasty extended play. And I believe Les Claypool, the frontman for Primus, talked about he wanted to do that song because he had a tricky time with the Sting vocals. So he figured he'd go, if he's going to do the Police, might as well do an instrumental. I thought that was pretty funny. But then also Andy was like, you know, well, I got a Grammy out of it, and Primus was a fan of it, so that's good enough for me. And I just thought it was like really cool to hear Andy Summers like seem to be really admiring of Primus. Like, made me all warm and fuzzy inside. So I did want to mention that.
Now I'm just picturing him trying to sing other Police songs, and yeah, in the same tone as like the South Park theme song, like. Voices in my head.
So I didn't go behind my camel for my pick. And I think I mentioned this off air, but I had a tough time trying to pick something. And it's because I like a lot of this album. There's not a lot that I really dislike. You know, it's more just like, you know, high floor, low ceiling type of thing. But I ended up going with part of a song. It's actually the song that I mentioned before, Shadows in the Rain. And it's more like the end of it. Like, I can dig the sort of, you know, slow, very relaxed pace, even though it's very different from the original version that I heard, which is the Sting cover of the song on his first solo album, which is a faster, much more chaotic version of the song. But I can dig like the groove of it. I just feel like at a certain point, it just feels like it's kind of repeating itself, just kind of like going in circles, and, you know, Sting's doing some scat vocals, but it doesn't feel particularly inspired. So it's more like, I would say the first, like, you know, 2 to 3 minutes of this song I'm kind of into, and then after that is where it starts to lose me a bit. So I'm gonna go with the end of Shadows in the Rain for my pick.
Yeah, I wrote in all caps, too long.
Yeah, so, I guess we're really on the same wavelength with some of this stuff.
Well, I think, Randy, we'll be interested to hear where you go, if you're of the same opinion or if you have one that maybe is controversial.
Yeah.
Sure. So here's where I get myself kicked off of the Police podcast, because I would like to sit down for a moment and explain to you why I just absolutely hate the song Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Called it.
I fully despise this song. Now, this is one of the most successful Police songs. I want to acknowledge that. I can even acknowledge why it's one of the most popular Police songs. It is catchy. It is a bit of an earworm. There is some interesting musical stuff happening here in this song. I get it. That's all true. It is the subject matter of this song that makes me hate it so much. However, here's what I am not going to do. I do not in any way think that Sting or the Police were trying to promote relationships between teachers and students. I do not in any way think that was the goal. I hate this song, but I in no way look down on someone for enjoying it, because it is catchy and musically relevant. So I'm not going after fans of this song. I am not really going after Sting or the Police. But I think this song is just the worst. I hate that it's one of their most popular songs. And I want to try to articulate why I feel that way. Now, to Sting's credit, he no longer chooses to perform this song. I was looking at a little article from People magazine that came out last May, just nearly a year ago now. They asked him about some of his most popular songs, some tracks he did with the Police, some of his solo tracks. And one of the songs was Don't Stand So Close to Me. And, you know, he made a point of saying this is not biographical, but people having relationships with teachers. It definitely happens. And in the song's defense, nothing happens. It's just the danger of something happens and the teacher is aware of it, which is why he's saying, don't stand so close to me. Now, I don't think I in any way interpreted that song as nothing happening between the teacher and the student, but I'm willing to give him that. That being said, this teacher does not seem to think that he has any control over the boundaries that he sets with his student or any control over where he is emotionally in this song. At one point in the song, he is literally crying about this relationship with this student, whether it is an imagined relationship or a real student. He is in emotional distress over it at one point in this song. He is crying. He is coughing. He is in all sorts of pain. There are accusations flying in the staff room. If I'm going to believe Sting's interpretation, perhaps he's imagining these accusations. But he is also talking about the other girls being jealous of this relationship or implied relationship with the teacher. None of this strikes me as nothing is happening or no boundaries are being crossed. And this is all incredibly troubling and distressing to me. Now, I am tempted to, you know, kind of write this off as being of the time, of it being simply kind of an immature song that a young man would write. Sting was a teacher, but is a very young man in his 20s. Again, I do not think that he was trying to write about some relationship that he had or anything like that. However, it is really dangerous to put a narrative out there into the world that a teacher cannot create safe and healthy boundaries with a student. And I think that's what frustrates me so much about this, because whether this is imagined or not, the language of this song is very accusatory of the girl in this situation. There's this implication that she is hitting the gas pedal on this thing and that he is powerless to control it. I find that really distressing. There is a reference to Lolita, a novel which I will admit I have never read. Now, at the center of Lolita, you have a character who is obsessed and in a sexual relationship with a young girl who is also his stepdaughter. Much smarter scholars than myself have dug into this book. And that book has a lot of fans. But even support of that book starts with a lot of mental gymnastics and groundwork where people are trying to establish that this book is not trying to glorify that relationship. That's where this whole thing has to start. Now, I could look at all of these things. I could say that Sting's trying to point out a problem and that maybe everything would be okay. But then the tone of this song completely throws that out the window, because that catchy little chorus of "Don't stand so close to me," it sounds like cute and fun and flirtatious and we're having a good time. It's a grand old time. They used the song for comic effect in an episode of Friends when the character of Joey takes part in an ad campaign to raise awareness about venereal disease. And the song is that no one would want to stand close to Joey because everyone thinks he is suffering venereal disease. It's jokey. It's flirty. It's this immature song about a teacher having no control over his boundaries with his students. And it's glorified. And what this song has in common with a novel like Lolita is a world where people thought it was okay to sexualize young girls, and that in those situations, they carry a lot of the responsibility. So this song is in that tradition for me, and I therefore hate it. Even if I do not think that Sting is trying to glorify these relationships. So I can't look past it, and I will forever hate this song, even if I can admit that it's gotten stuck in my head. That chorus has been in there before. Thank you.
Strong words in the staff room. It's interesting because Yeah, I mean, I can totally understand that. And I think, you know, when I first heard the song, I think I did tend to take it like at face value. It was like, okay, this is this guy and, you know, this underage girl is coming on to him and he doesn't know what to do. But I've also, like, more recently, I've been like, I'm wondering if this is like just like him, like if it's kind of like you're hearing like his side of things or almost his like justification for like how it has come to this point. And there that syncs up a little more with like the rest of the song because of like, hey, you have this, you know, don't stand so close. Like it's so diametric to the rest of it that it almost feels like, oh, like don't but do. Like it's almost like he's like not, you know, he's not putting his foot down, and it's really like on him to, with, you know, when he should have the power and control to do it and the responsibility to do it. But that said, yeah, it's definitely not a lighthearted topic. You know, it doesn't necessarily handhold you in like how you should feel about it. And I'm all for like open interpretation, but I can totally understand why you feel that way and why other people might feel that way and not like the song. I guess for me, I tend to go with that interpretation. And so I see it as more of a warning, but, you know, not everyone will interpret it that way. And so, yeah, I can definitely see why you and other people would feel that way, though.
Yeah, it's it's tricky because you certainly, I don't feel like I disagree with a lot of the, like, that there isn't a danger, and certainly that this particular way of framing it hasn't been used before and since, you know, to justify, I mean, frankly, not even just men, but anyone who has an underage relationship with someone, particularly in a school. You know, it's a really serious thing. I think that was part of why he decided not to sing it anymore. I guess the way I've looked at this song is that it is, I have seen it as hugely subjective, that it is, you are seeing it from his point of view, and in his mind, this is the temptation. It's almost, I believe naturalism is the term, of like things happening to you, you actually being in control of what happens. But I do think what is so key about the song to me is that there are, you have that chorus, which is really bouncy and fun, metrically opposed to the verse sections. And I would say that's like musically true as well as lyrically. And that to me is like, it's meant to make you kind of stop and be like, wait, what's going on in this song? Like, why, you know, it's not just fun and happy the whole time. It has really weird sections, one of which I'll get into a little bit later, you know, and certainly, you know, it's hard for me to tell based on the lyrics, like, okay, is this all imagined? Is some of this happening? Is some of it not? But I do think the fact that there does seem to be, there is a seriousness in the song about what's happening that might be outside of our sort of lead character, I guess, his perspective, that the song seems aware of. And there seems to be aware of the consequences of this thing in a way that to me seems, you know, again, aware of the situation and the seriousness of it. Yeah, it's a weird song. It's especially weird as like a hit song, given the subject matter. I think it's been interpreted a million ways, you know, with most of those interpretations probably being wrong. But I guess I've just always chosen to see it as like, this is a very subjective experience for this person in terms of, you know, coming to terms with this, with a real thing that happens, which is temptation. And the song is sort of ambiguous about how far it goes. But I think also in having those sort of diametrically opposed musical and lyrical sections, it's kind of showing how thin that line is between you know, between the thought and the action, and that this could go south really fast. And I think the song is kind of showing us that. Grant, would it be nice to have a perspective from, you know, the girl in this? Yeah, I think that would add a lot of dimension for sure. But also it does feel like the kind of thing that's maybe in keeping with some of the Police's other songs of being sort of trapped with a particular person. And we're kind of left to interpret and figure out, okay, is this a person that we can trust? Is this a reliable, you know, narrator, reliable person to follow? So yeah, it's complicated. I hear what you're saying. And I think you're coming at it from a place of good faith. But yeah, I guess I see it in maybe a slightly different way.
I just want to jump in like Chris and Justin. I think you both have such smart and thoughtful takes on this song. And I think if you are a fan of the Police and if you are listening to this podcast right now, you know, I don't think there's a Police fan out there who isn't listening to this song and looking at it in a thoughtful and intellectual sort of way. Right. In the same way that I don't think Sting is trying to promote this sort of behavior, I don't think that Police fans are allowing it either. But yeah, like I think maybe the line that best represents why it's so hard to balance it for me is the line, wet bus stop, she's waiting, his car is warm and dry. Because I was like, I don't know if any of those interpretations work for me, because on the one hand, it's like, is he meeting her at a bus stop to pick her up to carry out this affair? Or is he like driving by the school bus stop and like imagining picking her up? But, you know, I think and I think the other thing I'd say is I think when the song came out in 1980, I feel like probably Sting wrote it. I think he had some reflective ideas and I think it could chart, and I think he could release it without a lot of qualms, because I think society would just say, oh yeah, teacher being attracted to a student. That sounds like an acceptable and unavoidable thing. And I do think, to Sting's credit, I don't think the song really can play in the present in the same way. And I think it's okay to recognize that and move on. Can I share a silly anecdote about this song?
Sure.
You know I love my pop culture references. So one of my former students, as a matter of fact, told me that they once performed this song on the show Glee, which I have never watched an episode of in the past. So, of course, I looked up the YouTube clip, and this is one of the wildest things I have ever seen. Not being a fan of the show, I was able to piece together that, you know, there's a music teacher of some kind and a teenage girl who clearly had a huge crush on him. And in order to try to explain to her that this was not going to happen, he sings a mashup of Don't Stand So Close to Me by the Police and also Young Girl by Gary Puckett in the Union Gap. Young girl, get out of my mind. Are you familiar? So yeah. It's a mashup of these two songs. He's kind of mixing back and forth, and I think they did it to lean more on the like don't stand so close to me, the, you know, you'd better run, girl, like, you know, he's trying to focus on those elements. But some of that accusatory language still even made it into this like pop culture rendition of the song, which was really interesting. Granted, I'm shifting to the Gary Puckett and the Union Gap song here, but there's this line, like, I'm afraid that we'll go too far. And even on this little Glee mashup aimed at high school students, the language has changed to like, you'll go too far. That like, that sort of inherent accusatory language almost made it into that interpretation of a 2000 song. But it's a wild thing. It's an artifact. It's an earworm. And maybe I'm just mad that I found myself humming it during my prep block as a teacher at a school. And maybe that just made me angry that I did not appreciate that it was floating in my brain. Yeah. But now I've had a chance to strike back against it. And I think we can all move on in a healthy and happy way.
Yes. Yeah. It's I think there'll still be a lot of debate around it, you know, even today and probably in the future about this song. So but let's for now, let's move on to our da do 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 and our da 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 da. And actually, you would have the option of picking that song for that category if you wanted. I'm going to go first this time, and I'm going to go with Man in a Suitcase, another really catchy song that I like quite a bit. And this particular little quatrain was something that really jumped out to me. Another key for my collection. For security, I race for my connection. In a flying cage, you'll never get to know me well. The world's my oyster. My hotel room's a prison cell. So there's a lot going on here. This song, at least for my money, has been, I've seen it as about a constant traveler. You know, there's again that very bouncy kind of tone, which I feel like perhaps belies a life of loneliness and dissatisfaction. And this section in particular uses a lot of more, like, I'd say, positive imagery and idioms. You know, like, another key for my collection sounds like a really nice thing. But in the context of the song, it's really like, you know, is he talking about hotel keys? Is he talking about just like another place he's been, you know, and in a way where they just start to bleed together? And there doesn't really seem to be any sort of distinctive meaning about any of these places that he's been. Then you've got the bird in a flying cage. I love that image, right? This idea of the cage flying, not the bird, the cage flying, but the bird is still trapped inside. That's really cool. And then you've got the last line, world's my oyster, my hotel room's a prison cell. World's my oyster, you think of that as like a very positive thing. Like, hey, I've got the world, you know, at my fingertips. I can do whatever I want. And that's immediately undone in the same exact line with my hotel room's a prison cell. That's just where he is. He's stuck in these places. He's stuck in the same place no matter where he is in the world. I just think there's some really interesting contrast and a little bit of humor, but like a very sort of dark, acerbic kind of humor in this song and in this section in particular. So just a really, really interesting thing. I also just wanted to mention real quick, I have no idea if this is serious. I assume he's joking. But I saw in an interview that Sting, when asked about this, hey, is this about like life on the road? And he said, actually, it's about a ventriloquist dummy, which I'm looking at all the lyrics. I'm like, well, some of the lyrics wouldn't make sense if that were the case. But maybe some of them would. I don't know. Man in a Suitcase, I guess that makes sense. But I feel like he was pulling that interviewer's chain. But it certainly made me think about the song in a way I hadn't before. But there's still a lot here, even if it's not about a ventriloquist dummy.
Aren't there like airport noises in the song too? So yeah, I'm not buying that either.
Yeah, and he's racing for his connection. How's that, right? How's that work? I mean, I love the image of that, of a ventriloquist dummy racing through an airport, but
yeah, this, I don't care what they say. This is a song about travel. I lost track of where I read this, but I think I saw another jokey response from someone that it was about like a spy thriller show that was called Man in a Suitcase. It was like a UK show that ran in the 60s. And yeah, could it lean on that idea of like an international spy maybe living this life? Sure. Could you consider like a ventriloquist dummy like a fun metaphor for like how you might feel in that situation? Perhaps. But yeah, it's about travel. And again, all the traveling this band was doing on tour, like they went from tour to make this album and then right back on tour again. They're living in hotel rooms. You know, again, I'm leaning heavy into Andy's perspective from that documentary. But like for the last couple of tours, you know, he's separated from his wife. He's just like reeling. He describes them like doing a show and just getting ushered into three different cars straight back to the hotel room. And, you know, perhaps the other guys are having some healthier interactions, but Andy goes into this thing where he's just leaving the stage, getting shuttled to his hotel room, sometimes finding a companion for the night, and just really like going to this dark, self-destructive, antisocial mode. And I realize this is not Andy's song, but, you know, they were all living through that incredibly rigorous performing schedule where these tensions are getting higher. That's got to be emotionally exhausting at some point.
Yeah. And I think that comes through. And again, in a sort of like light, you know, light and comedic way. But also, you know, with that sort of undercurrent of darkness. But Randy, where did you go for your favorite lyric?
So I went right to the title of this segment. This is the de-doo-doo-doo section. And sure enough, this is the song I turned to from my lyrics. And I went with poets, priests, and politicians have words to thank for their positions, words that scream for your submission. And no one's jamming their transmission, because when their eloquence escapes you, their logic ties you up and rapes you. So there's a lot going on there. There's a lot to unpack. I went long on Don't Stand So Close to Me, so I'll try to keep it simple here, right? But what I love about this is, you know, we've got on this list poets, priests, and politicians. You know, poets and priests will often get a more positive description in our collective memory. Politicians, we all tend to be pretty upset about. But I do actually think this is something pretty insightful about folks who are able to harness language to achieve their positions of power. And people can do great things that way, but they can also oppress other people. They can simply equivocate and waste time and dance around an issue. You know, in America, we have so much political division. And whatever your personal politics are, there is a politician of any political persuasion who is guilty of this sort of like endless equivocating, using words versus action. You know, the language here gets very intense. But this idea that no one's jamming their transmission, the people who have made it into these halls of power, they're holding on to it. And then to counter that against the kind of, you know, silly gibberish of this song that it sits alongside. I found that really powerful. And one of the more intensive and thoughtful messages that's come through in a police song for me so far on all three albums.
Yeah, always really liked this one. And I was considering a couple lines from this one, you know, despite the fact that, you know, it's a song about simplicity of words and the chorus is, you know, da-da-da-da, which very much always made me think of Baby Talk. You know, it has some really nice lines in it. Like, it has some actual poetry in it. And that's kind of, I like that sort of that tension, that irony. But yeah, and that's a really, I love that he starts talking to the politicians after he's talking about like how he doesn't have the words to how he feels about something. And it's like saying, see, look what words can do. Like, here's proving my point. I just think structurally it's really smart the way where it falls in the song. But yeah, and it's just like a fun song musically too. Like, I just, every time like Andy hits the darn it, like it just, it's like punctuation. It's just really, really effective.
Yeah, until my most recent listen, I still thought to do 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 da 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 was just straight up like him like reacting to like kids and like their innocence and and yeah, it wasn't until I read the lyrics and read more, I was like, oh yeah, I totally misinterpreted this song. But yeah, I think that's good. Like, you know, charisma can carry you, you know, in certain professions and lead to people listening to you when what you're spouting is, you know, complete BS and the doo-doo-doos and the da-da-da's. So I think that's a great lyrics to highlight there.
How about you, Chris? Where did you go for your da-da-da-da's?
I went to Driven to Tears. I think, especially like when I first heard it, it had like a pretty big impact on me growing up. And I think it's interesting, you know, you think about when this is written and like it's still heavily potent to this day and still something that we haven't quite, like, it's crazy to think how numb we are still to it. But before I get ahead of myself, the lyrics I picked were, seems that when some innocents die, all we can offer them is a page in some magazine. Too many cameras and not enough food. This is what we've seen. And I think there's some interesting ways that he laid this out. he really made that second line like go on a bit long, but I feel like it was like on purpose. Is like, hey, like, and all we can do is like, it's like, hey, let's throw this in a magazine and make a story of it, and like, we did our job. We covered it. So I think it kind of like highlights the point of like, this happened, and out of everything we could have done, this is what we did. And I think the other great line is, too many cameras and not enough food. It's like, okay, like, how long have we been covering these stories? And like, it still remains that we're highlighting the problem, and we still haven't attempted to solve the problem. Further down the lyrics, makes a great point of like, protest is futile, nothing seems to get through, and then who knows what to do. I think that's a question we're still asking ourselves to this day. It's like, we want to do things, and like, individually we can only do so much, and you know, the feeling of like, the collective needs to do something, and the best we can do is just keep highlighting that the problem is there.
Yeah, one of the things that's always jumped out to me about this song is that sense of futility, of like, feeling overwhelmed by what you're seeing, but also feeling powerless to do anything about it. And I think those lyrics that you highlighted really illustrate that. And it's a universal feeling. There's always that question, like, what do we do? What do we do? But it's also, I think, kind of showing how this sort of addiction that we have to suffering without necessarily being spurred into action. And it is one of those things where I think, again, it's subtle. It's not, I think it's sort of, the song is sort of critiquing that, but also showing that it can be very easy to get wrapped up, to be overwhelmed by what you're seeing. But also there's a bit, you know, there's, the media is kind of designed to do that because that drives more circulation, more ads. It's understanding of that human impulse that we have to be overwhelmed by suffering, but also to show that there is a cause of this, and maybe there's something else that we should do, but it's not just like looking at more suffering. That doesn't seem to help anyone, ourselves or the people who are actually suffering.
Yeah, Chris, I absolutely love this pick, and probably because I had a couple of options here in this category, and I clipped those exact same lines from this song. They were on my list of possible candidates for this category. But yeah, that perhaps my favorite line within that section is, too many cameras and not enough food. It's just, it's wild that could feel so true in 1980 and feel so true in 2024. And the technology's changed, and, you know, instead of a magazine reference, we're going to talk about viral videos or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thematically, it goes so hand in hand, even like with the lines I picked as well, right? Because it's like, too many cameras, not enough food. And then we've got poets, priests, and politicians can use their words around all of this. And best case scenarios, maybe affect positive change or acquire resources. But more often than not, right, it's the lip service, and it's such an empty feeling when it feels like that's all we get when any sort of tragedy strikes. And but yeah, I think you captured that perfectly. So love that pick. Great choice.
Also, quick thought of, you know, talks about politicians and priests, but he also mentioned poets, and like it or not, Sting is a poet himself. So I feel like that's also a slight jab at himself as well.
Yeah, for all, you know, for all the all the criticism that Sting could heap on other people, he was not one to not heap it upon himself. He could be very self-deprecating. So yeah, let's move on to our musical moment, a little thing they did that was magic. And Chris, I'm going to go back to you for this one. What musical moment would you like to highlight?
Yeah, so you touched on it much earlier, but I went with Bombs Away, the guitar parts. I don't think Bombs Away is about a specific thing, but I've heard it mentioned of like the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and like perhaps like the thing to support that is like the solo definitely feels like Middle Eastern influenced. I feel that that was a really interesting choice and really interesting sound that Summers chose from that. I like that part, but I think the biggest thing that stands out to me is the soaring guitar at the end as like the chorus is fading. It just kind of like rises above everything, and yeah, I don't know. It just like opens things up in my mind, and I just love the sound of it and the way that it enters into the song. So I was considering going with the drumming on this album was great, and I was considering going with that part, but this distinctly stood out to me and figured I should give Andy some love too.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, obviously echo that. But Randy, where did you go for your musical moment?
Yeah, so I'm going to keep the love for Andy flowing. Mine is, it's in Behind My Camel. The way that guitar is like almost screeching at me, talking to me, I find it incredibly enchanting and engaging. I'm not going to litigate the Grammy situation. It is a bit of a surprising track to earn that honor, but I really feel like this song tells a story. I feel something so visceral when I listen to that. There's so much emotion in that guitar to me. It's wild to me that I don't hear this in movies and television shows all the time, because it's such an incredible piece of atmospheric music. It's really powerful. Again, my favorite documentary that I keep bringing up today, it's Andy's documentary, so obviously he's going to use his Grammy-winning song. But he uses that piece really effectively during a portion of the film where he is describing his own dark sort of downward spiral. And it's even more powerful to kind of see him reflecting back using that music. And it might even be something that's influencing what I hear and feel when I hear the song. But, you know, Hollywood, like, get this song into some movies, get it into some television shows. It's a really powerful piece of music. And the way that he made me feel like the guitar was talking to me, just, it's really impressive. I feel something. I'm always going to wonder what sort of cool song this could have been with some more collaboration from Sting. I will say my only knock against it is, again, it's 1980. I think in the grand scheme of things, it's great that bands like The Police brought us some global influences. But I do hate the title of this, Behind My Camel, which feels like some sort of vague, non-specific, generalized sort of way to label this as a song with some foreign influences. That feels kind of gross and immature. But the music's great, and I love that we got it.
I did just want to mention one quick thing that I've heard from Nigel Gray, who returned to produce this album. There was a little bit of tension there because he had asked for, he tried to ask for a percentage on this album as opposed to the last two, because The Police were getting much more financially successful than when they first started. And Miles ended up negotiating with him. So he ended up getting a larger flat rate than he had. I think it was like at least twice what he got in the last album. But his instincts were correct on wanting the percentage, because he would have been exponentially richer if that had worked out. But anyway, Nigel Gray talked about this song and said he wasn't 100% sure about it, but he was pretty sure the joke of calling it Behind My Camel was, what would you find behind my camel? A massive pile of crap. That seems to track with The Police's sense of humor, so it wouldn't surprise me. But I did think that was like, wow, I never thought of the title that way. Maybe I should have, given what I know about the band. But I'm gonna go somewhere different for my musical moment. I'm actually going back to Don't Stand So Close to Me. And if you've been following this podcast, you know, one thing I really love, it's an eerie sounding bridge. And I'm going with the bridge in this song. For me, is between the intro of the song and this moment. I ended up going with the bridge just because it stuck out to me a little bit more. But a thing I like about this bridge is it keeps adding layers. So around the middle of the song, you've got this sort of like sinister sounding synthesizer that plays through this section. and we're hearing like what sounds like sort of muffled arguments of some kind. It could be, you know, the strong words in the staff room, perhaps. It could be the fallout of a relationship. It could be an imagined fallout of a relationship that hasn't happened. And then we get this, we get that sort of earlier guitar riff sort of just kind of there, kind of like plucking along. And you've got Sting adding a vocal where he's singing wordlessly. And it almost feels like a bit despairing, feels isolated and strange. And I do feel like this is, again, maybe more in support of what Sting has said, where it does feel to me more like he's singing, almost like the character singing inside his head or something. Musically, it's sort of doing that. And I just really love the effect of it. Just like what, you know, like how many accessible pop songs have a section like that, where it's all of a sudden like you're in this weird, strange world that feels so alien from the, you know, the happy, bouncy chorus of this song. You know, I just think it alludes again to that more dark and sinister angle of this song and songs on this album. So just a moment I've always really loved and just always, again, just thought was so strange, but interesting and daring. And I just really love it.
If I'm not mistaken, it was a guitar synth during the bridge.
That sounds plausible. Yeah, I was trying to look at how they achieved it. I wasn't able to find a lot about it, but that sounds like that could be the case. You know, it almost sounds like they're doing like a run on the guitar synth. Like it's really strange. Like I feel like you use so many words that, you know, so many different ways to describe it, but it's really unique sounding.
And I had the Moog sound in the beginning.
Yeah, despite the fact that you guys let me do a self-indulgent rant about this song, nevertheless, on my list of musical moments, I have on my list the introduction to Don't Stand So Close to Me, because it really does suck you in. It sets such a powerful scene and sense of energy that even though I was going on a tirade, I couldn't help but have it on my list of possible musical moments, because there's some powerful stuff happening there.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that, at least. So guys, I know we haven't, there's maybe a few songs we haven't talked about yet. Are there any that you would like to spotlight? Maybe starting with you, Randy.
All right. I think we actually did hit all of my favorites. However, you know, one song that for whatever reason, when I was grooving out to all these tracks, that I did find myself genuinely enjoying was When the World is Running Down, You Make the Best of What's Still Around. It's a mouthful, but I really love the energy of that song. I was grooving. I was watching that basketball game, and that was one of the songs I found myself tapping my toes to a little bit and grooving to. And the fact that they managed to make that very long statement flow lyrically within the song, it's a fun track, and it's on that run of tracks that really define the sound and vibe of this album to me.
Nice. Yeah, I like that one a lot as well. One thing I was thinking of going with for the musical moment was the bass line in this song, to give some credit to Sting on the bass there. It's just constant. It's thrumming. I just love it throughout the whole thing. I also wanted to talk, we haven't talked about The Other Way of Stopping, which is the last instrumental on the album and is a Copeland composition. The title is, apparently, I didn't realize this until I was looking more into it. This is based on a sketch by Bob Newhart, where he's talking about Driver's Ed. And I actually listened to this sketch. This is a very old, this was like a routine that he would do. It was like stand-up almost. And it was like a driving instructor talking to someone who had had a really bad, who was trying to learn to drive, and the last instructor had like abandoned them in the middle of the lesson, and this new instructor is trying to find out what happened. But it's framed like you're not hearing the student, you're only hearing the new instructor trying to figure out what happened. And at one point it's like, oh, you're talking about The Other Way of Stopping, what would that be? Oh, throwing it completely in reverse. Okay. So that's kind of the joke. I don't know how that kind of figures into this instrumental particularly, But it's kind of amusing, and I think speaks to their, you know, again, to their sense of humor, and Stewart's in particular. Love the drumming in this instrumental, particularly. It makes sense with Stewart. But yeah, just really, really cool. Really cool song.
Yeah, I felt like Stewart used every single piece of his kit on this song. Yeah, some really interesting pieces in there, and makes you want to like try to replicate it yourself, even if you aren't a drummer at heart. Makes you want to air drum. Going quickly back to, because I just want to touch on a quick thing for, hold on, let me take a breath here. When the world is running down, you make the best of what's still around. agree with the really groovy beat to the song. I also found it interesting that in the lyrics, they end up like repeating the first verse and fading out. Almost kind of like emphasizing the lyrics of like played for years and years, like it's something that's just on repeat. And so I thought that was an interesting way to like reinforce some of the lyrics in that song.
So guys, I think we're gonna wrap it up there for now. But let's talk about other artists that we've been listening to. And I think I'm gonna start this time. I'm gonna go with a little bit of a different pick for me and perhaps for the podcast. So I think so far I've talked about some 90s grunge. I've talked about some late 60s, early 70s soul. And now I'm going to talk about some 19th century romantic era compositions, because I've been listening to a lot of Edvard Grieg, who is a Norwegian composer from Bergen, which means he's from the same place as my beloved black metal band Immortal. I thought that was very amusing. But Grieg was very active, as I mentioned, in the late 19th century, and a lot of his works were inspired by Norwegian folk and dance forms, which made him a little bit of an outlier from some of his contemporaries. And he was very connected with the literary world in Norway. He wrote pieces for Henrik Ibsen pieces. If anyone is familiar with drama, Ibsen is considered sort of the father of modern drama. And a lot of his plays are still performed. I believe A Doll's House was just performed on Broadway with Jessica Chastain. I actually was in a production of The Master Builder when I was living in Sacramento. That was a pretty challenging but rewarding piece, I would say. And so Grieg would write music for him. He also is also famous for something called the Holberg Suite, based on Ludvig Holberg, who was a Dano-Norwegian playwright from earlier, maybe like a couple centuries before Grieg's time, but someone who's very much venerated within Norway and is another playwright. So again, more of those literary influences. And what I'd say is so characteristic of Grieg's work is his works tend to have a lightness to them, but like a lightness of feel, but a depth of feeling, if that's possible. I know that another favorite composer of mine, Tchaikovsky, was a huge fan of Grieg and complimented Grieg for his beauty, originality, and warmth, which I always thought was really fun. I definitely recommend the Holberg Suite as a starting place if you're looking to get into Grieg's work. I think it really captures the full range of emotions, perhaps, that Ludvig Holberg was able to capture. It's sort of five different movements and very different tones, ranging from almost like a melodrama to comedic. Like it's really like a sort of full gamut of different emotions and moods. Movement four, or the airs, is probably my favorite section, and that's the one that's definitely the most sort of emotionally wrenching. I really like that in my in my more classical type of music, my orchestral music. But yeah, Grieg is definitely someone, a composer that's a favorite of mine. I just find his work, just very evocative, but yet that like has this lightness to it that's very, you know, uncharacteristic of maybe, again, some of his contemporaries, certainly, you know, some of your more heavy hitters in the classical world, if it comes like Beethoven or Mozart. That lightness, I think, really does distinguish him. So yeah, Grieg's been a lot of fun for me lately. But I don't know, are either of you familiar? You've probably, so I'll say, I didn't say some of his more famous works. In the Hall of the Mountain King is probably among his more, you know, recognizable things. You've probably heard in a million movie trailers. definitely one of those things you know when you hear it. The Morning Mood from Peer Gynt is another big one that I feel like has been used in a million like Warner Brothers cartoons. So, you know, his work is very much out there in pop culture, but the lesser known stuff is definitely worth checking out.
So my classical music knowledge is pretty weak. You know, I know like the biggies, the stuff you'd learn in elementary school. One of my favorite films is Amadeus. So like every bit of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart that was featured in that film means a lot to me. However, you mentioned the composer's name and I was like, wait, is that in the Hall of the Mountain King? And the reason that I knew it so well is because during COVID, I would run these Zoom games of the parlor game Werewolf, which is a social deduction game. And I was trying to be very theatrical with it. So during these little breaks we would take, I had like a playlist where I was playing different atmospheric music, including a couple of classical pieces in the Hall of the Mountain King was one of them. So I went and found my old COVID playlist and there it was. Yeah, a real classic piece. That's a great call out.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that makes complete sense to me, though. I think that would work really well for that. So, Randy, I'm going to assume you have you maybe have not been listening to 19th century composers, but what have you been listening to?
You know, sadly, I haven't. But, you know, I went back into more recent history, which is my youth. I think I have a few years on you guys, but do you have any familiarity with the band OK Go?
Yes. I think like most people my age, I probably knew their music videos first. So that's most of my familiarity. But I've certainly heard more than just, you know, Here It Goes Again. Like I know a bunch of other songs that they've done, all of which they've done music videos for.
Chris, do you have any history with OK Go?
No.
So, yeah, so the reason I bring this band up is they were first introduced to me in the early 2000s. You know, I was finishing up high school, starting college, and when I first was exposed to this band, even though their name did not start with a the, I grouped them in with all of the bands, you know, The Hives, The Strokes, The White Stripes, etc. And they had some music that kind of fit into that vibe and that genre and that style. In 2004, they had one of like the earliest viral videos, which was the Here It Goes Again music video, where they did this whole choreographed routine on a series of treadmills. That was a really cool, quirky, like low budget video. And they've continued to put together some great stuff musically, you know, in that sort of alternative rock vein. But the reason this band means so much to me is it's because it is some music I've been able to bond with my son over. And it is because not only is the music great, but they took that treadmill music video and they have just increasingly challenged themselves to create these wildly compelling music video experiences in the years that followed. And, you know, on the way home from this basketball game I keep talking about last night, I was flipping through my sort of random playlist and an OK Go song came on and my son wanted me to stop. And it just got me feeling sentimental. You know, it's been about nearly 10 years now since the last full OK Go album, which is a bummer. But, you know, they have done a music video where they played an entire song on a car that they rigged up with speakers and different appendages, where they were using a bunch of discarded old pianos and guitars and driving by them with a car. They filmed a zero gravity music video in an airplane where they had to choreograph 27 seconds at a time of weightlessness to create this whole video experience. They did an extreme slow motion video with controlled timed out explosions. And they have these really thoughtful behind the scenes videos. And the fact that they've taken music, combined it with creativity, math, art, these learning experiences, it's such a cool way to interact with the music and get you to stop and think about how it's timed out. Where do those dramatic moments hit? And, you know, unfortunately, they recently had to have a whole legal battle with Post breakfast cereals because they wanted to name a breakfast brand OK Go! Exclamation point. And they got sucked into a whole legal battle, which they did finally win. They're a really great band. I would just honestly say start with the music videos. Search OK Go! Music videos and you're going to get a whole host of things. They did a full complex Rube Goldberg machine synced up to one of their songs. For my money, they had the most successful COVID song altogether now, which was really, truly and genuinely touching. So I just love that band. They're fun and creative, and there's something there for you no matter what.
Yeah, definitely familiar. I've seen, I think, all the videos that you mentioned, and probably multiple times. I think the Zero Gravity one always stands out to me just because it's like a lot of fun to watch, and like the way that they especially like match the verse sections with them like floating through the air. Like that's just, it's really cool. And also it feels even more authentic because the last part of the video, you can tell that the choreography was for them to get back into their seats at the end. And because of all the chaos that's been happening up to that point where they've had like suitcases full of, you know, balloons and mini disco balls and all this stuff, and they're in zero gravity, one of the suitcases ends up unintentionally in one of the seats, and you can see the guy try desperately trying to get it out so they can do it in the beat and they can like get it in that take. It's just like that makes it feel so much more authentic, and you just really feel like, wow, this is real. Like this is not, you know, to me that actually made it more impressive, you know, and the commitment to getting that take. I think that was really fun. So that's a really fun pick. And the music is as we've said before on the, you know, talking about Zenyatta Madonna, it's insanely catchy and it's really fun. Like I think, like, to be honest, I think a lot of those songs could stand up on their own as really fun pop songs. They just happen to be done by these guys who do these really cool videos too. So
yeah, admittedly I'm not as up to date on, or I'm not as in tune with indie rock in general, so you know, that's a, you know, open spot for me to, that could use some exploring on my end.
Chris, I'm going to recommend the Needing Getting video to you because as someone who loves metal, I think the image and the sound of a vehicle driving by a row of electric guitars that have been propped up against a fence, I think that sound will appeal to you and unlock something primal within you. It's a very cool moment.
So Chris, what have you been exploring then? What artists have you been listening to?
Speaking of primal, I've been listening to a video game soundtrack of a recent video game, Doom Eternal. I believe it came out in 2020, and it was songs were created by Mick Gordon. And a lot of the music is based in metal. It's the type of music, like some games you play and you hear the music, you're like, oh, I should listen, you know, oh, I really want to listen to that music again. This was music where I hadn't played the game, listened to the music, and I was like, oh, I want to play this game. The songs that they have in here are like, just evokes the feeling that like it's your own personal boss music and you're the boss. So I find it great for like workouts or just like general pump up music. It has some great buildups in the songs. They're generally instrumental, or maybe like you'll have like, you know, not necessarily vocals, but you'll have like kind of some, you know, evoking mobs of enemies, let's say. And it has a really, yeah, like some really gritty guitar parts. Like they're just like super in your face and yeah, just give you a complete adrenaline surge. A couple of the ones that really stood out for me, and I love some of the titles to these: Meat Hook, The Only Thing They Fear Is You, and BFG Division 2020. BFG stands for Big Gun, and you can figure out what the F in the middle stands for. But yeah, some really, really
friendly
fun songs. Yes, yes. Yeah, I've really enjoyed listening to these as a means of, yeah, pumping me up, and on workouts, it's a good way to way to really pump yourself up and go, you know, go crazy on some things in your life that you know, you want to take down and tackle.
Believe it or not, way back when I played the very like the first two games, I never got to play Doom 3, which I think is where they really like reinvented the series, and that was like a much, you know, they're working on a more sophisticated console at that point. So I've lost track of how many Doom games there are, but it doesn't surprise me to hear that the music is really awesome, and then what I'm assuming is one of the later, you know, one of the latest ones, because I know that they've really like kind of taken that series and tried to do something new with it. My guess is that it bears probably more, you know, less relation to the original game and maybe more to, you know, perhaps something like Dead Space or something. But yeah, it's an interesting series, but it's like anything else, you know, the influences can come from anywhere. You know, there's a lot of great games with music and for different reasons. And but I do like a metal, you know, metal inspired soundtrack. I think that's really fun. You know, maybe not the most common thing in video games. So that's really nice to know about.
Yeah, I won't get into, there was some like controversy around like, I think there was like a short timeline to like get this out. And then like there were issues with, I guess, like the editing, and then like there was some weird stuff where like they weren't really giving mid credit, but,
Okay.
I won't delve into it too much, but it's interesting because like what he was able to produce, I thought was really great. And I think also like people inspired to like give the songs like their credit and amplify what Mick produced. Like there's been a bunch of like remixes that have like been focused on updating some of the editing to make it, you know, more consumable. So whether you're listening to the original soundtrack or some mixes of it, I think it's really, really fun. And like, I'm not the biggest metalhead, and some of that is depends on the vocals for me sometimes, but this is one that's like just super catchy, in your face, and makes you feel invincible.
Very cool. All right, so I think we'll wrap it up there for now, but let's talk about where we can find everybody. I guess, Chris, for you, as always, we'll continue to hear you on here as well as on Pirate Rock Angels, The Rush Hour. But Randy, where can we find your stuff online?
All right. If you are looking to find me on social media, you can find me on Twitter at Mr_Alain, A-L-L-A-I-N. And also, as Justin was kind enough to mention earlier in the pod, I recently, 2 weeks ago, launched my own podcast called Media Lit. You can search for that on all your favorite podcast catchers. It's literally media, / and then the word lit, where we look at all different types of media. We examine them as great literature. I talked to my buddy Chris, no relation to our Chris here today, who is a hardcore Batman fan. He's also an actor on the side. And he took a look back at Batman Returns from 1992. We really dug into how that sort of forged our interest in pop culture and media. And then we really broke down the film and what's so special about that silly, campy film. So be on the lookout for more things like that, but with a variety of media. I think our next episode is going to be on an episode of Doctor Who. So there you go.
And is that, would you say that, is that available on all podcasting platforms?
Yeah, you should be able to find it just about anywhere. Spotify, Apple Podcast, okay. Pocket Cast, etc.
And as for me, you can find my work on thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at the Cinemaverick, where you can see all the, I've now completed watching all my 2022 films. I've moved on to 2023 Oscar films, so all of a sudden I'm current, which is kind of cool. You know, there's some good ones, and boy, oh boy, howdy, are there a lot of mediocre ones. Wow. Okay. It's, you know, I was getting some really, like, I'd saved a lot of, like, some of the stronger 2022 films, and I was like, man, seeing some really good stuff, and then I'm going to the Oscars from this year, and I'm just like, wow, okay, yeah, this is what we're dealing with now. Okay, all right. Anyway, so you can find my thoughts there. You can also find me, as I mentioned, on Pod on the Rooftops and Podbreak Angels of the Rush Hour. You can find us on the Pop Break Today feed, where you can also find this podcast. I also just wanted to plug really quick, when this goes up, I will have some top 10 lists for bands that I really enjoy. I believe I'm going to be starting with Rush. That'll be the first one. You'll get my top 10 songs. You'll get my rankings of the albums, and you will get my favorite song by each album. So that's Rush. Will start that off. I have one for Nirvana that's also ready to go. Probably be Deftones after that, because I'm sort of wrapping that one up. So yeah, so all this will be there. And there'll be many more bands to come. Many, 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 many more bands to come. So that's where you can find some of my stuff. But for now, this, I guess, will be our fourth goodbye. So we want to thank you for staying with us. Thank you to my co-hosts, as always. And we will talk to you very soon.